to But What If I Soar podcast. With your host, Dominique, licensed professional counselor and certified clinical trauma professional and owner of Free to Be Counseling Service, and Deveron, licensed social worker and certified life coach and owner of Social MacGyver. The thought-provoking podcast that explores the complexity of mental health through a lens that does not require a prescription. We will explore a wide range of topics with engaging discussions and personal anecdotes that provides a realistic outlook while actively engaging in our own self-discovery. Let's get ready to soar together.
Welcome back to another episode, But What If I Soar? This is episode number 21. I am your co-host, Deveron Social MacGyver.
And I am your other co-host, Dominique Flint, Free to Be Counseling Services. Welcome back.
Yes. So today is actually going to be a episode. It might be a part of a series. So for those who do not know, the month of September is two major awareness topics. So the first one is National Suicide Prevention Month, and then the other is National Recovery Month. And so we thought it was appropriate to do some podcasts on these two topics as they are near and dear to our heart, as well as just really important to bring attention to, not just for the month of September, but bring as much attention to all the time. People suffer in silence. And so the more that we talk about these things, the more that we have these dialogue and exchange information, it helps people to feel seen, feel heard, and maybe encourage them to reach out and get connected to help and resources instead of just struggling in silence and feeling like no one can understand or help them through what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a necessary topic to discuss. And I mean, I think there's, to your point, there's so many people who don't know how to get through these moments. And so hopefully some of the things that we talk about today and throughout this month can be helpful to our listeners. So we definitely appreciate you all listening. And hopefully some of this information will be useful, if not for you, for maybe somebody you know.
Yes, because you just never know. We want to start with a trigger warning. So again, today's episode, we're going to be talking about suicide. We're going to be talking about warnings, things to kind of pay attention to. We're also going to be talking about some situations that we ourselves have dealt with clinically and things that we have found helpful when addressing suicide ideation. And just, thoughts of self-harm. And so we just want to make sure that everyone is aware that this episode may be a little bit heavy. You may know someone who has had an attempt, or maybe that, they did pass away from suicide, or maybe yourself has struggled with having thoughts to harm yourself. We definitely want you to be able to listen, but where you feel comfortable. And one of the things that we'll talk about a lot is the National Suicide Hotline, which has now reduced its numbers. It's just 988. I always tell people it's a resource that you never know when you need it. And so it's always important to have on hand because it may not be you who's struggling with it. It may be a loved one. It may be a friend, or maybe someone that you are just in passing by and you notice that something is amiss and you want to provide some type of resource or support. So 988 is the national crisis line, and you're able to get connected with a clinician who may be able to assist and provide you with resources. So that's always important. And then again, if you feel like you or someone you love or know is in imminent danger, please call 911 or get them to the closest emergency room.
Yeah. And we're going to make sure we probably leave some more resources in our show notes. So be looking out for those, when the actual episode does drop.
Yes. So we are going to talk about, I guess, some of the things that we'll talk about is people feeling like they have thoughts of wanting to die. Sometimes the thoughts may be around purpose. religious or spiritual feelings, feeling of guilt or shame. And then sometimes they also may feel like they're a burden to others. And so I think it's important to highlight these things. And there's other numerous things that could be also feelings and, you know, thoughts of what they're going through. But these are some of the more common thoughts, I would say, that we might hear or talk about when someone is talking about thoughts to harm themselves.
Because some other ones are particular feelings, right? So someone, these are warning signs you want to kind of keep a lookout for. And so if someone is describing feeling empty or hopeless, feeling trapped or not having any reason to live. So maybe they're struggling with future oriented thinking. Maybe they're like, I don't know what I'm going to be doing next week or next month. I don't have any real plans for my future. Then that is something to be concerned with. Maybe someone is experiencing extreme sadness. Maybe they're a lot more anxious, or maybe they are experiencing agitation or irritation, or even sometimes full rage. That is something to keep in mind, that could potentially be a warning sign to maybe, you know, thoughts of suicide. Last thing too is, you know, there's a big connection between people who are experiencing unbearable emotional or physical pain. Physical pain in particular, you know, again, we don't often think that physical pain can lead to someone experiencing suicidal thoughts, but there's such a big correlation between physical pain and suicidality. I also want to make sure we stress that these warning signs don't, if you know someone who's experienced it, they don't necessarily mean someone is suicidal or can be, but these are just things to kind of keep in mind, you know, if you are engaging or interacting with someone who may have, may have some of these symptoms.
The other thing I think we should put as a disclaimer is that there may be someone who is experiencing these and questioning, you know, their purpose and things like that, and having thoughts about, you know, their life and struggling with suicide ideation, but they may not be in a place where they are having any intent, plan, where they're actually wanting to act on the thoughts. There are some individuals who may have, you know, when you talk with them, they will tell you that they have questioned living for many years. They've lived with suicide ideation. Some people may even describe it as their baseline, right? That they don't really can recall a time when they didn't have thoughts about their life and whether or not they should be here or not. But when you dig a little bit deeper, you realize that they are, I don't want to say coping with the thoughts, but there's no intent or plan, or they haven't taken any action on the thoughts, and that they are utilizing coping skills to help them through having those thoughts. But they have kind of come to a place where they are understanding that the thoughts are there and they ebb and flow, and that they utilize good coping skills when the thoughts are a little bit more heavier than other times. So that's really important to kind of consider, because one of the things I will say in the past, working with clients who may report having suicide ideation, sometimes family members didn't understand. They thought, well, they're still saying that they had these thoughts. They need to, you know, be back hospitalized and things like that. And again, I get that concern, but they're not really listening to their loved one and saying like, yes, I do have these thoughts, but there's no plan or intent to harm myself. It's just something that I'm figuring out how to live with. Right. And the thoughts are a part of me. And again, I think, you know, when anyone hears something like that, we as humans never want to see another human suffering. And we never want to see them feel like they just have to accept something. And so we want to fix it, right? We want to help. We want to provide some type of aid, some type of assistance. I think we also need to listen and hear what a person is saying to us, because it can provide a little bit more insight on how you can support them, right? So I think that that's definitely important to put as a disclaimer, that someone may tell you that they're having suicide ideation, but it's always good to get them connected to someone to dig a little bit deeper, to assess them fully, to see exactly if they are in danger, because that's going to elicit a different type of response.
Absolutely. That's a really, really good point. People live with chronic suicidal thoughts all the time, and they're just there, right? And they have no plan or intent or desire to act on them. So I think that will warrant a different set of interventions and circumstances. So yeah, I think you're right to point that out. Some other changing behaviors that you might witness, and these may become warning signs to someone's suicidal intentions. So if someone is making a plan, or if they're researching ways to die, that may be something to keep in mind. If they are more, if they're isolating more, withdrawing from their friends and their relationships, if they're saying goodbye or giving away some of their more important items, or making a will, those things may be cautionary for you to kind of pay attention to. If someone is taking dangerous risks, you know, and again, dangerous is relative, but you know, things like maybe risky driving, just risky behaviors, you know, you want to pay attention to that. Someone is displaying extreme mood swings. If someone is eating or sleeping more or less, or if someone is using drugs or alcohol more often, those are some behavior changes that may be worth exploring. And that information, I want to make sure, I don't know if we cited, but that information, warning signs specifically, are coming from the National Institute of Mental Health.
One other warning sign I like to bring up is if you are a part of a group or have like a close loved one who has recently passed from suicide, it's always good to pay attention to your loved ones who are amongst that group, because sometimes that can actually give people the extra push to act on their thoughts. Whereas previously they, you know, may have just sat with the thoughts and were too scared to act on them or anything like that. When you have someone who you know has actually went through with, you know, a plan and action of harming themselves, it can also give another person encouragement that they too can do it. So it's always good to check in with your loved ones, or even if you have kiddos and you know, they know someone who recently has passed away. It's always good to just check in and just call a spade a spade, just call it out, you know, have these real discussions no matter how hard they are. And if you don't feel like you're equipped to do that, you know, there's so many different professionals who are able to assist you in having those discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, risk factors, this list that we acquired comes from the Center for Disease Control, and some risk factors. And I just, again, we should also say that these are not exhaustive lists. So there's tons more risk factors and warning signs that we could talk about. These are just some of the more these are just some of the ones we thought we wanted to highlight. So again, there's definitely more. So we wanted to also kind of go through risk factors. And risk factors just essentially mean that this person with these experiences may find themselves more at risk of engaging in suicide, you know, suicide attempts or experiencing suicidal ideations. And so some of these risk factors include if you've had a previous suicide attempt, if you have a history of mental illness or a history of depression, if you have a history of chronic pain. If you have a history or have experienced criminal or legal problems, job or financial problems.
So community risk factors. So community risk factors are going to be any type of like changing or challenging issues with a person's community. So think about like lack of access to healthcare. So Dom had brought up earlier, you know, pain being a, you know, a risk factor, right? And so think about if someone is struggling with some type of healthcare needs and they do not have access to healthcare resources, that can definitely be a risk factor, especially if they are suffering with chronic pain or like a chronic health issue. Another thing is going to be historical trauma. So think about a community that has just had a lot of different trauma back to back. That can definitely be a risk factor as well. Because again, when you think about pain, right? A lot of times we think about physical pain, but there's also the emotional pain, right? Emotional aspect. And I think that some people tend to forget that, that a lot of people have limits of how much they can tolerate. And then not only that, there's a threshold, right? And if you've had all of these different events that have been very traumatic and very emotionally painful, that could definitely be a risk factor because you don't know what someone's threshold is. You don't know what someone's line where they just feel like it's just too much to bear is. Mm-hmm. So it's always important to pay attention to things that are happening around us and it happening to the people in our community. And then discrimination. Again, discrimination can be from so many different avenues. It can be, you know, racially driven. It can be discrimination economically driven. It's just so many different aspects that can be impacting a community and something to pay attention to. And so again, if you are you or someone you love or someone you know, you are seeing these themes taking place, it's always good to pay a little bit more close attention. And like we talked about at the beginning of this is that oftentimes people suffer in silence. And so sometimes, even though we are highlighting some risk factors to be pay attention to, it can be where there's not these like screaming, sound the alarm type of risk factors, right? It can be very a small amount of risk factors that you can lead someone to have these type of thoughts and actually want to act on them. So it's just important to, if you are aware of any of these things happening, that you just pay a little bit more caution to yourself or those around you that you care about.
Okay. And then the last set of risk factors are societal risk factors. And these are cultural and environmental factors within a larger society that may contribute to someone's risk. And so one of those may be if you experience stigma associated with help seeking or mental illness, right? So if you are, you know, if you are involved in a broader society that, you know, shuns people for seeking help, or even someone who just is experiencing mental illness, that can add to your risk. If you are struggling with easy access, or if you have easy access rather to lethal means of suicide among people at risk. Again, we'll get into some of these statistics around, you know, suicide by state. But if you live in an environment that, you know, is not opposed to large amounts of lethal means, you know, that could make you more at risk, especially if it's not frowned upon, right? If it's kind of part of the larger culture, then, you know, it may make you more at risk. And people may not necessarily question having access to lethal means because it's just part of that particular culture. And then lastly, if you are experiencing or you're around or you have access to unsafe media that portrays suicide, you know, often, you know, that portrayal, that those images of individuals who may be experiencing suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, you know, sometimes those things can make us desensitized to these particular experiences. And so that can leave you more at risk as well. And again, these are not exhaustive lists. These are just some lists that are some items on this list that, you know, we wanted you all to be aware of.
And I like the last point you brought up, because I remember it was a couple years ago, Netflix had a show called 13 Reasons, which was a really good show, but it had a lot of different trauma scenarios. And I don't think when I initially started watching it that I was fully aware of what the show was about. I thought, honestly, when I first started watching it, it was like, you know, one of these like teenage kind of like, you know, just dramas, right?
Yeah.
But it was so much more. It was very, very, took you on a journey emotionally, right? I think it wasn't until towards the end of the season or even the second season that they actually had to put a disclaimer on the beginning of the episodes to, you know, make people aware that there was going to be self-harm and just numerous things. And so that just brings up that, because there, you know, there was a girl who harmed herself. She took her life. I think it was the first season, but it was very graphic. You know, they showed a lot. And I think, you know, I personally was not prepared for everything that they showed. And I don't know if they have since changed, you know, what is in the episode, because I haven't watched it in a long time. But it took you on a journey, I will just say.
It definitely did. Yeah, for sure. I agree. While it was really good, because it was a like kind of a high school portrayal, almost like this coming of age type of, you know, genre of TV. I don't know that it would have the same impact on adults that it would have on kids. I think adults can be impacted too, but just in a different way. And so where we may have more ability to manage some of the emotions that were associated with that, I don't know that kids could have that same level of, and so I think those disclaimers were helpful, you know, as they kind of started to realize that it was having a bigger societal impact than maybe they initially thought it would.
Yeah. Now, I definitely think it was a show that was clinically, I appreciated it. At the time I was working with teens, so we did have a lot of processing groups. And so we were able to use some of the material from it to have processing and meaningful groups. But I think, you know, it was a show that I watched and I was like, yo, we got to talk to these kids. Like, we got to have more discussions, because it was a little too real. You know, it was too real. And I think initially people thought it was, you know, it's TV. They add a flair to it to make you want to watch it. And I'm just like, no, like, these kids are hurting. And that was years ago. So this was, you know, before COVID. So, I definitely think it prompted for me as a clinician, we have to have more meaningful discussions. But I think for other parents that I spoke with, they were having, you know, they were having to process it, because kids were watching it on their own, you know, on Netflix. There wasn't anyone to kind of like process what they were viewing, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
So Dawn was very great at getting some stats. And one of the stats that she got is actually from the CDC. And this is going to be a list of the top states that have experienced suicide. And so the number of deaths were per 100,000 total their population. So some of these may be surprising to you, some of them may not. So the first top state is going to be Montana, Alaska, Wyoming, New Mexico, North Dakota, Idaho, Utah, North Dakota, Oklahoma, and Colorado. So I will say I wasn't surprised to see Alaska on there, especially because I know that oftentimes what we see is like seasonal depression, especially when it comes to weather changes. So I know, like, I was surprised that I didn't see the Washington State on here, because I know that they deal with a lot of like rainy seasons. And I do know I've heard stats where there is a lot of seasonal depression there. But for like Alaska, you know, they go half the year, I believe, in darkness. And so we know the benefits that vitamin D does for us. We also know from research the lack of vitamin D, the impact that that can also have on our function. And so I think that that definitely probably plays a role. And then you also have just the climate that they also have to deal with, you know. And I think more so, you know, obviously if you live there all your life, maybe you've adjusted a little bit more to it. But I also think about someone who may be struggling with like chronic pain, like myself. I know after my car accident, when it is rainy outside or it starts to get cold, my back tends to flare up. And so I tend to have more trouble with my back in the colder months. And so I was thinking about maybe that also may be contributing to it. People who deal with like chronic pain and the colder weather having more of an impact on that. But again, that's just from my own personal experiences. And then obviously data that, you know, kind of highlights that cold can kind of cause flare-ups and things like that.
Yeah. So I wanted to say two things. First thing, I made an error and I want to correct it. I put North Dakota on this list twice. It should be South Dakota at number 8. So North Dakota was number 5. South Dakota was 8. I made a little error there. The second thing I want to say is about a year ago, I listened to a podcast and I think it's called Last Day. It's such a great podcast and I will make sure to get accurate details on that if we want to put this in the show notes. But it was about two very different areas of the world. One was the state of Montana. The other one was the city of Atlanta. And they spent time focusing on gun violence that happens in both those states. One or both those parts of the world. In Montana, they focused on suicide rates. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what are the most common ways that people carry out suicide. But in particular, because of Montana's gun culture, that was why they highlighted, that was one of the reasons why they highlighted this particular state. It was one of the, I actually left a review. I never leave reviews on podcasts. I listen to too many to do that. But this podcast series was so good that I had to go leave a review. The way they talked about, you know, as often we talk about gun violence and we talk about it from the perspective of, you know, someone using a gun to murder someone. We never really have the same level of visceral response to the way someone uses a gun to kill themselves. We don't really seem to have the same level of like energy and, you know, kind of this visceral response that we get when we talk about, you know, crime and gun violence, you know. And so it was such a great podcast. And so when I was going through this list, it made me think about, well, like we talk so much, the media talks so much about gun violence, but I don't really see a lot of the media talking about, you know, suicide rates and that killing yourself is also an act of violence. It's also an act of harm, and not just to the person, but like to the survivors of people who kill themselves, people who unalive themselves. Right. And so I just thought it was a very good podcast. I would recommend anybody listen to it. The episodes that they did on the city of Atlanta, I think were great as well. But I think there's so much content around gun violence and what people, you know, say, quote unquote, like black on black crime, which is not a real thing. But that was something I wanted to add. That episode about Montana specifically, I thought was just beautifully done. It was sad, obviously, but it gave a lot of good insight to, you know, a part of the world that maybe you don't know a whole lot about. And it just gave good insight to gun violence from that perspective of, you know, suicide. So So we have some more stats. So according to the CDC, so some of these stats are going to be from the CDC. Some are going to be from SAMHSA. So we just want to make sure that we kind of give you, you know, some details about where we got this information from. So from the CDC, as of 2021, so this is 3 years old, suicide is the leading cause of death in America, the United States, to specific groups. And so suicide is the second leading cause of death for kids ages 10 to 14. Suicide is the third leading cause of death for people ages 15 to 24. It's the fourth leading cause of death for people ages 25 to 34. The sixth leading cause of death for, or I'm sorry, the fourth leading cause of death for ages 25 to 34. I think I said that. I'm sorry. The fifth leading cause of death for people ages 35 to 44. The sixth leading cause of death for people ages 45 to 54. And the seventh leading cause of death for people ages 55 to 64. So I just wanted to give a breakdown of, you know, specific age groups and how, you know, based on data, the way that those particular age groups are impacted by suicide.
And we do know that there's been lots of data that shows that the pandemic has really had an impact on the youth, and that it has definitely increased suicide numbers for risk. And one of the things that I think, and I'm not sure if it's broken down in here, but one of the things that I often talk about is, you know, when I was younger, it was often talked about suicide generally impacts males much more than females. But also culturally, it tends to impact other races more than like those in the African American population. But we are seeing an increase amongst African American youth with suicide rates. And so I think that it's definitely something to pay attention to, because if we just go off of what has been like the norm trends, it can definitely be where we are missing a significant group that is suffering. And I think we're going to say this numerous times, but when you talk about suicide ideation, you talk about this idea of suffering in silence. And one of the ways that people can suffer in silence is for them to not even be identified as a group who could be struggling with some of these concerns and issues. And so I think it's really important to highlight that, especially as, you know, parents or caregivers of youth who fit that description, right? It's really important that you bring attention to it and know that don't just say, oh, this is this type of group's problem, or it only impacts this type of group, because it can leave your kiddos who suffer in silence. And, you know, when someone is suffering in silence, oftentimes they are dealing with some heavy things, and they're going to be making decisions that for them in that moment may feel like the only thing that they have. Whereas if they had someone to talk with, maybe they could have been giving some type of other resources to make them open up and think about things in different perspective. But again, when you're suffering in silence and you're suffering alone, you're only going off of your own perception. And, you know, you're having a dialogue with just yourself, right? And so sometimes that may keep you in a place, whereas if you're talking with someone else, you might be able to have openings to see things in other lights. So I think it's important to have these meaningful discussions and not just think that it fits a certain mold of things. Like, I don't fit that group, so I don't have to worry about this. I think that suicide ideation is a everyone issue, right? It's a everyone needs to have these discussions and needs to be prepared to be aware of what the warning signs is, because it can impact anyone, just like substance use. You just never know until it's in your backyard.
Yeah. Well said. Absolutely. Yeah.
So leading into that, Dom actually has some more stats. So the CDC in 2021 did say that males are 4 times higher than females to act on suicide ideation, right? So again, it's not saying that females do not act on their thoughts. It's just saying that males, stats has shown that males are more often going to act on the thoughts. But again, still need to pay attention, right? It can impact anyone. And it's really important to bring clarity to that. Among males, suicide rates were the highest for males ages 75 and older, which I think like is a statistics to highlight, right?
Yes.
Because 75 and older, what is that population dealing with, right?
Yeah.
When you think about 75 and older, for the most part, this person has lived a good part of their life, right?
Yeah.
I think it's definitely something to dig a little bit more into. I did used to work with elder population. One of the things people don't realize is sometimes even if you are able to live a long and meaningful life, one of the things people don't talk about in older age is that some of the people that you love and have memories with, they start to pass.
Yeah. Yeah.
It can be a very isolating and lonely thing. The other thing is the loss of independence, the loss of purpose. That can really be something to struggle with, especially if you're not equipped to process it. If you are someone who maybe has been the norm to, you know, you just grind it out and you don't talk to anybody, you know, if life is hard, especially, you know, depending on what you've been through, maybe it's just that you feel like that's just what life is. You work, you know, you do what you need to do, you take care of your family, and that's what it is. And so like, you know, sometimes what I have found is older adults, especially older males, can sometimes struggle with that, asking for help, reaching out, seeing a clinician, because in their day and age, you didn't talk to people about your problems. You know, if you had problems, oh, well, everyone has a problem, right? That shouldn't stop you from doing what is needed, which, you know, in their time, it probably worked for them, right? It helped them to be able to cope with whatever they faced. But at some point, that may no longer do it for them, or maybe they were able to find purpose in something else. But again, when you're getting to that age of 75, you might be in retirement, you know, you've raised your family if you've had one. Now the kids are, you know, they're doing their own thing. They're living their life. Maybe they don't have as much time for you as they previously did. So again, that sense of purpose, you know, may be something that is causing you a lot of questioning. You're not really sure what to do, right? You don't have like this goal, right? Especially if you're a goal-oriented person, right? I definitely think that that could be something that that age group could struggle with. Dom, I knew she was going to come with this. So she has stats about race and ethnicity. So American Indian and non-Hispanic males, they have a rate of 43.3 per 100,000 population. And think about the list that we talked about earlier about states that had the higher rates. Remember, Alaska was on there. The other thing is culturally, some cultures, it is actually not taboo to act on suicidal thoughts. Actually, some cultures feel that it is, I don't want to say like a blessing, but it is more meaningful to act on those thoughts than to cause your family suffering and, you know, and just to live amongst it, right? So that's something to really pay attention to as well. Whites that are considered non-Hispanic males, they had 30 per 100,000. And then white non-Hispanic females were at a rate of 7.5 per 100,000. So I think that that's definitely interesting. The other thing to kind of highlight as well is that American Indian and Alaskan Natives, non-Hispanic, for females had a rate of 13.5 per 100,000. So again, we talked about understanding how that might play in different ethnic and race groups, but again, still understanding that it can impact anyone, right? It doesn't matter what you identify as, you know, people struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had some stats from the CDC as well, and these stats came out in 2021, and these were the most common methods of suicide, or, you know, and it included firearms, suffocation, or poisoning. And so when it came to, these are broken down, by gender. And so if we're looking at female, suicide by firearm, they, that way of carrying out suicide happened at 34.5%, die or suicide by suffocation happened at 28.4%. And then poisoning happened at 27.8%. Now, this is just for female. When it came to males, overwhelmingly males attempt suicide or complete suicide at 59.8% with firearm. And then with suffocation, 25.1%. So yeah, we just wanted to make sure we kind of broke down like what were the methods of suicide that generally happen as a result of, you know, someone engaging in suicidal behaviors.
I like that you highlight that. I remember I attended a suicide awareness training, and it was ran by a clinician who worked for the VA. And she was talking about access to lethal means. And so basically what she was saying was that they had data that supported this, that it, when someone has a suicidal thought, they have about 8 seconds where if they don't have access to lethal means, it greatly reduces the amount that they're at risk, right? Mm-hmm. And so because, for instance, the more complicated it is to act on that thought, the more time you have to think about it, yep. Instead of being, you know, very like quick and like, I don't even have to think, right? So like, for instance, one of the things she would talk about is like, if you have pills, right? So the, like, you may have the thought and you may think about like, okay, I have these pills, but then you have to get up, you have to go get the pills, you have to open the pill container. And so this is all helping you to have more time to sit with your thoughts, mm-hmm. That could basically save your life. Whereas if someone has access to lethal means, oftentimes it's a very quick response, mm-hmm. and there's not too much time to think. And so she was talking about, and this was more so in dealing with veterans, is trying to give them more time to think about, you know, what they were kind of going on in their head, so that they didn't make, you know, kind of like a split decision. It gave them time to kind of think, you know, whether it be thinking about their loved ones, thinking about, you know, future plans, something to give them just another moment, with their thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so I always think about that of when we talk about access to lethal means, even as simple of having like a gun locker, for your mm-hmm. weapons, making sure that when you are storing your guns, that they are not loaded, right? Again, mm-hmm. that you still have access to lethal means, but it also takes you a little bit of time to have access to it. It's not readily available. So again, mm-hmm. You know, not to go into too much detail, but you do have to actually prepare the weapon to use it. And so that gives you more time to think about things.
Yeah.
And hopefully that can save your life, where, you know, maybe you reach out to someone, maybe you call the suicide hotline number, whatever. Some there's enough time to intervene than if you just have things readily available to you. So mm-hmm. that always has been something that constantly plays into my head. Of when someone does say that they're struggling with suicide ideation, trying to maximize that, you know, 8 seconds, mm-hmm. to really help them, you know, try and make a little bit more of a decision on what other resources they might be able to connect with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. For sure. There's a few other stats. These stats are suicidal thoughts and behaviors. And this is as of 2022. And this comes from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA. So this kind of breaks down suicidal thoughts and behaviors amongst particular age groups. So 5.2% of adults ages 18 and older in the United States had thoughts of suicide. Adults across all age groups, I guess when looking at adults of all age groups, serious suicidal thoughts were the highest among ages 18 to 25, at 13.6%. And then, again, looking at adults across all age groups, serious suicidal thoughts were the highest among those who identified with two or more races. So when I think of like the age groups, right, I think of like 18 and older. I mean, it doesn't really kind of give a particular breakdown in terms of adulthood. But when you look at 18 to 25, you know, you look at like these are college age kids. These are kids who are in the workforce and who are probably experiencing a lot of challenges around like where they're going to live, if they're going to be able to afford where they're going to live, do they have a roommate, are they trying to pay for bills on their own? I just wonder how much do economic challenges play a part in this particular age groups, who experience serious suicidal thoughts, and especially among the highest of all adults was 18 to 25. I just am curious about, and then you have like 25. So, right, you're getting out of college, right? You think, I got this degree, I'm going to like work. And you realize that you're not being introduced to great prospects at that time when you get out of, right? So I just, and again, not to suggest that everyone who's in that age is in college, but I mean, I just am curious about what factors are those people facing that would suggest that their rate of suicidal thoughts are the highest among adults. I'm just curious about like what else besides economic factors would be playing a part in that. So, yeah.
No, I think that's a good question. I do think, you know, one of the things I definitely, you know, when people are doing research and they are looking at stats and developing this data, we're always behind the bell curve in this. So, right. Yeah. So like, a lot of data now is talking about how the impact that, you know, the pandemic had on different populations. Right. And obviously that's years later. Right. And so now I feel like with the cost of living being so high and, people just not really struggling to like repay their student loans. And I just read like a stat, like the average car payment is like $1,000 a month.
Wow.
Just these crazy amounts of things. And I think about like, you know, and again, this is not saying that everyone goes to college, but I think about, you know, one of the promises or the,
yep,
kind of like the buy-in that you have. It's like you go and get this degree and you'll be able to like make a living and things like that, right? And you want to make a living, you want to have a career and things like that. And so you invest in yourself, but in investing in yourself, you also are hit with these crazy amounts of student loans. And even if you didn't start up with a ton of student loans, the interest rates alone are just horrible.
Yeah.
And then the thing that they don't talk to you about is like when you are repaying your student loans, they don't take into consideration other bills. They don't take into consideration cost of living and things like that. And so it's not that for, I would say, the majority of people, it's not that they don't want to pay their student loans back. It's that oftentimes these lenders don't work with you. And so the amounts that they are telling you that you will be having to pay monthly, if you aren't making that much money, you're having to decide where that money goes. You really have to pick and choose what you're going to do, right? Yeah. So I definitely think that I would like to see the statistics on that. And obviously it's going to take a while for that to be generated, but I would love to see, you know, what impact that has on people's mental health and functioning. Because I think one of the things that a common thing we talk about is purpose and being future oriented. But if you are so straddled with the current, you know, your present concerns, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's such a heavy thing to process that you don't have space, you don't have bandwidth to think about the future, right? Because you're in the here and now. And so I would like to see what the data says around that, right? Mm-hmm. How many people are so overloaded with their present day concerns that they can't even think about or give space to what the future could bring because the thought alone is just so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to see what the data says around that because I think that, you know, depending on what generation you talk with, some people are a little bit more forgiving of how of that importance. But as I like to explain to some of my older clients is, you know, one of the things that you were promised was if you worked really hard and you put your head down and really did the grind, you'd be able to afford a house. You'd be able to take care of your loved ones, right? Like, and not saying that you would be rolling in the dough, but you could live, right? And I think now, I'm not sure if these younger generations are having that same faith in the systems that are in place.
They don't have the same faith. I mean, they don't. And they're not wrong.
So I do would like to know like what impact that has though on purpose, right? And then what is the correlation to that to having unsafe thoughts, to, you know, acting on these thoughts? I think that that would be a good place to kind of do some research and see. I'm just interested in it.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up some really good points. I think that certain generations, and we could say like even, you know, what would it be? Gen X or even older millennials or, you know, the boomer generation, they're Some of their ideas about, you know, younger generations, you know, maybe younger millennials, maybe Gen Y, Gen Z, they have this, and again, it's general. I don't want to say that everyone in that generation does, but I think that they'll say things like, well, I paid for college when I went. I'm like, well, when'd you go? In 1929? Like, when tuition was fucking $75? Like, right. That, like, no one's working to pay for school right now. Like, that's not a thing.
No.
You know? And so I think sometimes they're very short-sighted in what their expectations for, you know, younger generations are when they're not even tapped in, or they have no kind of understanding of what this generation is facing. I think I read a stat that said like this is going to be the first time that you know, certain generations will have less access to things like owning a home and having a 401k and being able to do better than their parents. Most generations, the kids do better than their parents from the previous generation. This is going to be the first time where they don't.
So that's actually scary because we think about, well, we just talked about these stats, right? Like, let's think about this. Let's dive a little bit deeper. I like this. So think about generational, how that will impact generations, right? So kids, right? Their feelings of themselves, right? Especially if it has been ingrained in them that their identity is and their worth is driven by what they are able to accomplish, right? But also think about parents. So we talked about the stats support this. In 2021, it stated that males ages 75 and older having suicidal rates, right? High suicidal rates. Well, think about this. What impact is this going to have on that generation? Because think about how they would feel about being a burden
yep.
to their loved ones
yep.
who are already struggling, right?
Yep.
Because oftentimes when you, you know, I don't want to say like you cash it in, but the goal is that you have worked hard enough that you are able to, you know, be able to sustain yourself.
And live comfortably.
Yeah, and live comfortably. But also, you know, think about if you have loved ones who you're not able to help and support, and you see them struggling, and yeah. then you're struggling as well. And think about the it actually has increased in people going to nursing homes, home health care, insurances, depending on what insurances you have. We talked about this.
They're not paying for it.
Of access to adequate health care. So mm-hmm. think about how all of those trends will impact the older generation. Because
yeah.
one, being a burden, feeling like they're a burden to their loved ones, financially, emotionally, but also seeing their loved ones struggle and feeling like they're not able to aid in helping them. Because the thing is that not every parent or caregiver feels like they are no longer responsible for their child after yeah. they reach a certain age, right? And so, like, I know for myself, I was very blessed for my stepmom to, and I call her my bonus mom, to constantly help me while I was in college, you know, and she's helped me numerous times. My father has helped me numerous times. When my mother was alive, she helped me numerous times. And so I would think, like, if I was in a place and struggling, for them to love me, I think that it would be very hard for them to see that, especially if their part of their purpose is yeah. to be able to aid in their loved ones when they see them struggling, right? So mm-hmm. I would love to see how these current trends, the impact it has on not just, because I think sometimes we're short-sighted and we just think of it being like this, it only impacts this generation, right?
Yeah.
You know, a couple years ago, it was like, if you guys stopped buying Starbucks, you'd be able to like be financially responsible and make better
yeah.
decisions.
I'm like, a $5 fucking coffee? What the hell do you think that is? That's not you.
You know,
pinching pennies on $5 coffees? Like, come on.
But I would love to see just someone do a deep dive on, mm-hmm. you know, how these trends impact each generation
yeah.
and the concerns that each generation has, how it does contribute to impacting their mental health. Because again, it may not be someone who is in their 70s, who's in their 70s feeling like they're concerned about the housing market, right? But it
yeah.
could be that someone in their 70s who, you know, has been able to have home ownership or whatever, maybe they're in a place like my bonus mom. She has a house that's way too big for her. And so she's in a place where she knows physically she needs a smaller home. And she knows that that would help her overall health, because she's been trying to keep up with a bigger home and like the yard and stuff. But financially, because of the prices of home ownership right now,
yeah,
she should just stay where she's at, right? Even though physically it's having an impact on her, right? And it mm-hmm. and physically it would be better for her health to make a move. Financially, it's not. And so, like,
right.
you know, you think about that. And I think when we talk about these, have these discussions about home ownership, I think sometimes the older generation is left out of that. And we're not thinking about how they also are impacted and how that can lead to a increase or decrease in their mental well-being, and how that could impact these type of topics, you know, suicide yeah. ideation, things like that. So mm-hmm. I think you bring up a really good point, and I think it would be interesting to have someone look further into this.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I'm sure someone has. I mean, I'm sure if we looked at certain investigative journalists, you know, companies and organizations, I'm sure there's been some kind of deep dive here. I'd be interested in seeing, you know, if someone has actually done that and what the findings have been, because I think there's so much we just don't even think about, you know, when we think about the impacts of economics, access to resources, and you know, what someone is going to need over the lifespan, right? Like, so what someone's needs are going to be over the lifespan. I mean, even you think about somebody who's 75 years old, a lot of 75-year-olds are still working because they can't reap the benefits of retirement, right? So, like, again, when you, if you're 75 and you probably were told 40 years ago that you could retire and, you know, travel and, you know, go camping and RVing for the rest of your days, and you're like, I'm 75 and I gotta work a part-time job because, you know, my retirement and my Social Security, that's probably gonna be non-existent for my generation, is not enough. You know what I mean? So I think even that is something that we don't even think about, because retirement age normally is, you know, we think like, you know, fun in the sun, like, you know, living it up. And it's like, nah, bitch, I gotta work. You know?
And life expectancy has continued to increase, right? And mm-hmm. and yet the trends in supporting that, I don't think have actually been altered or adjusted to take that into consideration. To me is very interesting. I like to look at the correlation of things. And I think, you know, when we talk about and have these type of discussions, when we talk about suicide ideation or even just suicide awareness, I think it's important to talk about these type of things because it allows us to have context. It allows mm-hmm. us to have more meaningful discussions on how we can implement policies and procedures to help those, right? Like, you know, I think about the elderly population and how I'm seeing so many elder communities being built, these new bills, but I do question the size of the homes, the price of the homes, you know, it just doesn't seem to be realistic. But also, like, you know, when I think about my bonus mom and, you know, where I would like, you know, if money was not an issue, I would like a place where she had, you know, access to healthcare in walking distance, or, you know, if I, you know, because at some point she won't be able to drive, you know, be able to get her Uber and things like that. And so, you know, I would want her in walking distance of a good healthcare provider. I would want her in walking distance of some type of adequate, that's important, food resource, right? Because the other thing we know is that you can live in a lower economic community and the access that you have, those resources may not be adequate, right? So
they may not even exist. You know,
or you could be in a place where they are taking advantage of being the only you know, dog in the town, right? So, you know, I think we know back home there's a grocery store that is literally right in town, and they've always been known to have higher prices than if you went to like a Hermitage, right? And so, but think about people having access, right? So if you don't have access to transportation, you have to shop where you can. You always find a Family Dollar, right? But I don't go to Family Dollar too much, but I will say the Family Dollars that I've been to, I don't think that they have had like fresh fruits and vegetables. They definitely started serving groceries, but a lot of it is pantry stuff and like some frozen item, but they're not like quality food. Like I wouldn't, if I got to pick, it wouldn't be the grocery store that I would pick. So I definitely think about that when you talk about just how all of those things could play on someone's overall functioning. I think when we have these type of discussions, we have to talk about overall functioning. And this is going to be a very taboo thing to say, and I'm just going to say it. As a clinician who has worked with people at different points of their lives, I think one of the hardest things I ever had to come to terms with was that you can't save everyone. And how do you allow someone to live or, you know, whatever they choose with dignity.
Yeah.
And when do you allow self-determination to play a role? So I think that that's always like a taboo thing for a clinician to talk about. And I'm not saying where we actively play a role in someone, you know, making the choice to end their life. But I do think that we have to be respectful of, not saying you have to understand it, because I personally have never lost a client directly, but I have worked with other clinicians, with clients who did end up taking their lives. And from those experiences, I will say it was difficult. It was, you know, a difficult thing to process. And I don't think it was like difficult as far as like they shouldn't have did it. It was more difficult of, what more could I do to help them see other options? And I think one of the things that helped me in those situations was like, you could do everything possible. But like, we can't confine someone, you know, to a space for the rest of their lives. You can't force someone to live a life that they don't want to live. And that's really, I don't want to play a god. I don't want to play a puppet master. I obviously don't ever want someone to take their own life. But I also understand my limitations. And I think by accepting and acknowledging that, that allows you to continue to do the work, because I think that what people don't realize is that it is heavy when you're dealing with someone who has unsafe thoughts, and trying to support them as much as possible. But you also have to understand that you can't do it all on your own. So that's something that I think I came to terms with a long time ago, is like meeting people where they're at, providing as much resources as possible, trying to make safe plans with them, trying to pull in other resources, other supports to them, because I can't be everything for everyone. But also acknowledging that that person also has a role. And sometimes things can happen.
And all of it is beyond our control. I think the thing that has often helped me in challenging and overwhelming situations, like managing or helping a client manage their suicidal thoughts, is that like, I'm not that powerful. I'm not that powerful to stop someone from harming themselves. I'm not that powerful to stop someone from relapsing. I'm just not that powerful. And when you recognize that you're not, you can be a better resource to empowering someone else to, you know, do the work that it takes to stay alive, if that's what they want, right? Like, I'm not powerful enough to, I mean, you talk about burnout. That's where you get to burnout, where that you are powerful enough to like stop someone from doing something that they want to do. If they want to do it, they will do it. Now, is suicide preventable? It is preventable, but it's also something that is beyond our control, because we're not in the driver's seat of people's lives, and we're not in the driver's seat of people's choice of self-determination. We're just not. And so, I think that those are lessons I wish I would have gotten early on. It took a while, but I think sometimes you have to go through some of that stuff to get to this place of like, you know, like you were saying, you know, and like I'm saying, that, you know, you're not that important either. Like, they're not going to harm themselves because you're so great as a therapist. Like, no, that's not. No.
And really the goal is, when you work with someone who is having suicide ideation, really it is you know, when we talk about like a safety plan, I used to work in acute psych hospital, right? And so when someone would admit and they, you know, would report having suicide ideation, really what it was in preparing them to go home, it was to identify like what their triggers were, identify what their warning signs were for them, but also like a collateral. So like, you know, whether it be like a loved one or a spouse or, you know, a mom, a father, someone who was a little bit more connected with this individual, things for them to be aware of, but also things for them to implement in a toolbox of when the thoughts come, how can I do my best to keep myself safe? Because really they play a major role. And then having their loved ones also be a part of the plan of what can they do to support this person in trying to make them as safe as possible. And understanding that the thoughts are fleeting. And so the intensity of them ebbs and flows. And so really, again, like I talked about earlier, limiting their access to make a rash decision that maybe if they had a little bit more time, they would not have made that decision, or they may have been able to sit a little bit more in it. And so trying to reduce their access to imminent danger, imminent risk, because that allows them to have just a little bit more time. I always tell people, when I worked in the hospital, like they would say, you know, if someone did act on a thought, and let's say they digested pills, there's a little bit more time of like pumping their stomach, things like that. But a gunshot wound, it's a little bit more, you know what I'm saying? Like the damage is a lot more, greater. And the odds of them coming back from that, are just not as high as if someone, you know, it could give them, you know, pump their stomach, things like that. And so that is just something that I always think about is trying to, it's not my job because we don't have, you know, clinicians, we don't have these magical wands that we carry around.
Sure don't.
It's not my job to heal them from these thoughts, right? It's really my job to help provide them with resources and tools and coping skills that when the thoughts come, they're able to implement these different things to help them deal with the thoughts, help them deal with the intensity or, you know, wherever the thoughts may come in at, but also allowing them just enough time to implement something that the thoughts, you know, can go away or they decrease or whatever. That's giving someone time to think about something else. Think about a loved one. Think about themselves. Think about their future. Something, some type of intervention can be utilized. That's really what a clinician's job is helping a client think about different things in a different light and accessing tools. Because the thing is, we could do a great session, right? We have a wonderful session. But when you leave my office, life is still going to be life in, right? You can have a wonderful session and then you walk out my door and you get a phone call. And it could send your world crashing around you. It is that client's, you know, their role to implement some of these tools that we have processed and kind of learned in session when those things happen. Because it's just like when you go into an acute psych unit, right? You're safe for that moment, but you can't stay there forever, right? Like if you go into rehab, you can't stay there forever. It's a limited amount of time. Even when someone is on like suicide watch or you call in a wellness check or whatever, you can't sit with someone. We're not talking about like babies, right? We're not talking about a baby who can't walk, can't crawl. It literally requires you to move. Talking about a human being who has free will. So it's really our job to try and help them come up with tools and techniques to help them process whatever they're dealing with in different intensities to just feel like, you know what, maybe this too shall pass or whatever, you know, whatever saying you want to put in there to just give them a moment of thought. Instead of just acting, I think that's the way I like to look at, you know, different techniques for suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have one more stat, and then what we're going to do is save the, I mean, we already kind of started digging in a little bit about how we as clinicians help clients manage and empower themselves to make choices to stay alive. And so what we'll do is we'll do the last stat, and then we will do our how we soar, and then we will save the next podcast episode for all of the questions that we want to kind of talk about in terms of how, what our personal experiences have been in terms of helping clients manage suicidal thoughts, and just like what are some of the things that we've learned along our careers so far about how to help someone, you know, how to help someone kind of strategize around their mental health as it relates to suicidal thoughts. So the last stat is, again, according to SAMHSA, and it is related to, I thought this stat was pretty interesting. So as of 2022, 13.2 million adult Americans age 18 and older reported having serious or severe suicidal thoughts. Of that 13.2 million, 1.6 million American adults attempted suicide. Of that 13.2 million, 3.8 million adult Americans made suicidal plans. 1.2 million American adults made plans and attempted suicide. And 320,000 made no plan and attempted suicide. So it kind of breaks down the importance of, or not importance, but it breaks down this idea of, you know, someone who was thoughtful about their suicidal plans and someone who was impulsive about their suicidal plans, right? That there are lots of people who don't make a plan and still attempt. There are lots of people who make plans but don't follow through. There are lots of people who make plans and follow through. So I think it was interesting to see, you know, the amount of people who fell in what category as it relates to, you know, if they acted on those suicidal thoughts or not.
And that's a big number. 13.2 million.
Yeah.
Huge number. Mm-hmm. I would like to know, of the 3.8 million who made plans but did not act on them, what interventions were helpful.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about suicide ideation, I think it's a very taboo subject. And I think, especially when you put in like religious and spiritual feelings, but I think it's a meaningful discussion to have of what kept you here. Right.
Yeah.
Especially
what are those, what we call protective factors.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what were the protective factors, especially if you are telling me a laundry list of things that are not going right for you. Right. And again, your protective factors of what kept you here may not be the same protective factors of what kept someone else here. Right. But I think it is a meaningful discussion to have with someone, because it can help you to, again, implement policies and procedures on how to continue to do the fight, right? And also in just developing policies and procedures to help people live this life. This life can be hard, right?
Yeah.
This life can be, it ebbs and flows. It can be very challenging. And so I think anytime we could talk to someone who was at a place where they felt like there was no way forward, I think it's always a meaningful discussion. Like, what was your process? What were your thoughts? You know, I think just like when you talk to older people, and they always say you have so much to learn from like older people. And I always say we also have a lot to learn from children, right? Because they see the world in a different lens that they're not, you know, they haven't been hit.
They're not tainted yet.
Yeah, they're not tainted. So, but I also think it's a good conversation to have with people who are tainted, right? Because sometimes there's something there for someone who 13.8 million, that's a huge number, mm-hmm. made an active plan. And it takes a lot to make a plan. Let's be real about that. It takes a lot to make a plan because you're thinking of your ending.
Yeah.
You're thinking of your ending. And I don't care what anybody says, when you're thinking of your ending, there's a lot that comes into your mind. You know, mm-hmm. it's like your life goes right before your eyes. And so they're thinking of their ending. They're making this plan. And something keeps them there. That mm-hmm. is very powerful to me. I personally think that that's something powerful. And I think having these discussions with someone who's been there could be very meaningful in helping other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's useful for the person who made the plan, because if you made the plan but didn't act on it, like, it is such a... It's such good information to, you know, kind of get inside their mind. Like, what happened? Why did you act on it? What helped you overcome those urges? You know, like, how can we use those strategies when and if those thoughts come back? Right? Because it is very common that those thoughts may come back. And if they do come back, how can we utilize this successful attempt at not acting on those thoughts to help be like a set of strategies for you in the future? Now, we don't know that those things will work again, but I think it can give people confidence that, like, those thoughts I don't have to succumb to those thoughts. You know, I can have those thoughts, and I can have a plan, and I don't have to succumb to that plan. How can I use what I've already experienced or what I've already successfully experienced as a tool, right? To not, not act on those thoughts in the future, or not act on the plan specifically in the future.
Yeah, no, I like that question. I just think that, you know, because it's such a taboo thing to talk about, I wonder if, you know, like, we talk about having, like, peer specialists for people in recovery, right? I wonder if, and I'm not saying that this would be beneficial, but I do wonder if it could be, there would be a benefit to having someone who's had these thoughts and were able to implement protective factors to keep them here. If that would be someone who could be meaningful to have a discussion with someone who is currently struggling with the thoughts and, you know, able to kind of talk with them and sit with them and, you know, find some type of common ground. You know, it's just something I think about.
I don't disagree, because one of the things that you often will hear from clients in recovery when they're working with their therapist is like, I mean, they often use it as a way to, well, I don't want to assume, but sometimes they use this strategy of like, well, you're not in recovery or you're not an addict, you don't know. And so having a recovery peer specialist assists them in that, like, this person gets it. They understand because they lived it, and they're living a life of recovery, right? Mm-hmm. So similar to that, how could someone who is struggling with suicidal ideations benefit from having almost a peer support who's also, and I think they do have, I think it's more so around serious mental illness. I don't know if it's specific to suicidal thoughts or suicidal mm-hmm. ideations. Or someone who's overcome suicide attempts. But similar to that, I think it could, you know, in some ways help that person who is trying to overcome feel seen in a way that, like, if I've never experienced that, and it's not always appropriate to share those things with a client anyway. You know, if you want to keep, you know, a level of boundaries, and you want to, you know, keep that separation, it's not always appropriate, even if I was someone who experienced that stuff. But, you know, being seen on that level, there's just something that, like, a clinician may not be able to provide that, you know? And so, yeah, I think it's a good question. You know, how could someone benefit from having a peer support of that in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you're able to find common ground as an additional resource, right? Like, because obviously we talked about self-determination. I definitely think that they should be working with a clinician as well. But I also think when we talk about suicide, you know, we talk about, again, suffering in silence. And I think that it said something to have someone feel seen on all levels. And when we talk about suicide ideation, I know, you know, and obviously we're going to, you know, wrap this up for the next episode, but I know, you know, some clients have felt very like dirty. You know, it was like they had to be in a vulnerable place to even want to talk about it. Especially, males, especially African-American males. And so I just wonder, you know, what that could possibly do as an added resource to people who are struggling, especially if they haven't said that part out loud to anyone. You know, how beneficial it could be. Just a thought.
All right. Well, we are going to, because this is, you know, National Suicide Prevention Month, we are going to, you know, our next episode will be a part of this series, and we will kind of get into some questions that we thought could be helpful and maybe highlighting some of our own experiences clinically working with clients who may struggle with suicidal ideations. And we may even talk a little bit about, I know this is recovery month too, so we may even talk a little bit about just some stats on recovery, and, you know, again, some questions, because we both have extensive experience working in substance abuse treatment as well. So so with that, Deborah Ron, tell me a little bit about how you're going to soar for the next few weeks.
I think the way I'm going to soar is just keep being on my grind, you know, professionally, trying to find a balance. The kids are back to school, so that's always fun. The sports have resumed, so trying to find a balance with that. I want to go to some, what is it, like Harvest Orchards for the fall. So fall is my favorite season, even though I was born in the summer. I love fall because I love layering. And so I just want to enjoy that if it ever comes, because this weather has been crazy. But so I just want to like enjoy the fall. Like I want to get back to drinking like some iced coffee here, but also my warm coffee, get like my little sweater. Like, I just love that. So I'm looking for that. I'm hoping that by, you know, towards the end of September, maybe we might get a little bit of fall here. It trickled in a little bit and then it like went away. And then this end of the month is our anniversary. So we'll, you know, find some way to celebrate that. And then it's also Mercy's birthday this week. So trying to find some way to, you know, celebrate that as well with all the kids. So I think just continuing to push myself to find a balance with work, home life, you know, everything, and just continuously finding ways to honor myself in all these different roles that I play. You know, I think it's important, and we have the holidays coming up, and as a, you know, a clinician, for a lot of clinicians, they know that the holidays are an influx time of people needing support. So I think for a big part of me continuing to soar is to find time to recharge my battery, because if I'm not recharging my battery, I am not able to give to others. And I am a giver. That is one of the importance of who I am. And so I just need to find time and ways to continue to recharge my battery so that I am at the greatest, you know, amount to give to others. So what about you?
Well, parenting is having a bit of a chokehold. If chokehold was a picture, I would be right there like this. So I am going to soar the next 2 weeks by trying to pour into just kind of revamping my philosophy on parenting. I think I understand my philosophy, but I think there are times when I lose a little bit of confidence in terms of, like, am I doing the right things? Am I truly understanding, you know, and am I open to making adjustments, you know, in my philosophy? I think that that is the work that I think I need to do. I've had just some interesting conversations over the past week. This week has been just challenging, amongst other things, not just the parenting, but I think some extra added things kind of, you know, made things difficult. And so, you know, I think I'm always invested in recognizing that, like, it's not one particular thing that makes parenting difficult, right? That it's often multitude of things, and just trying to keep that perspective in mind, you know, when I am, you know, trying to self-reflect on, you know, what has happened and what my role has been in that. So that's one way I want to definitely try to soar over the course of the next couple of weeks. I also just want to find some time to, like, do more journaling. I think I've just slacked on that. And I think that I think, you know, I'm a thinker, and being able to kind of jot down some things that I've been kind of, that's been stuck in my head has been helpful. And I haven't been able to do that. I think I also need to really commit to more meditation. I'm just noticing some areas where I think I can probably grow a little bit, and that can also help to alleviate some of the, you know, some of the changes that we are going through right now with parenting, or at least that I'm going through with parenting right now. So those are some things that I want to definitely commit to for the next couple of weeks. And I want to also, like, reading has still trying to tackle that too. So, So those are some of the things that I want to do, but I also just want to rest and relax. I don't want to put too much pressure on myself. Like, that can be part of the problem too, or part of an area where I need to adjust. So also just taking moments to rest. So I definitely caught up on a lot of my TV shows. That made me feel good. Just not thinking about work and not thinking about things I need to do. And just, like, I stayed up super late on Friday watching all the shows that I wanted to catch up on, and that felt good. So just also just trying to, you know, do some of those things too, because I think that not doing those things can also leave you feeling, you know, just like you're doing so much work and not enough play. You know what I mean? I want to make sure that I'm also doing the things that are just my things, that have nothing to do with work or being a mom or being a wife, just like things that are just for me, you know? So, and it's the simple stuff for me. It's not always like going out. Sometimes it's for real, just staying in and just, you know, watching TV and just doing the things that I, you know, that make just, sometimes I need that alone time. That alone time recharges me. So those are some of the things that I would like to do. So make sure that you reach out to us on social media. You know, our social media pages are, But What If I Soar for the podcast, Free to Be Counseling Services, and Therapy with Dom on TikTok, Free to Be Counseling Services on Instagram, and then Social MacGyver on Instagram. Make sure you follow our YouTube page, which is But What If I Soar. You can see our previous podcast episodes on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can also leave us a review. We would love that. We want to hear your feedback. I want to see how you feel about what we're doing. And just, you know, again, this is something that we are passionate about and we are trying to build. And we're not in a rush to build some, you know, big time podcast, but anything that, you know, you all want to share with us about what this experience has been for you all as you've gone on this journey with us, we are more than appreciative of getting that feedback. And so you can share that information with us on our handles that we just shared, or you can send us an email. You can send us an email at butwhatifisoar@gmail.com. We would, you know, be very appreciative of any feedback that you want to share, any topics you want us to cover. So with that, we will be back with a part two on this National Suicide Prevention Month, talking a little bit more about our experiences working with clinicians or working as clinicians in the mental health field around suicide and suicide prevention.
And we will make sure we include some resources in our section in the bubble below, as well as, like I said, I think next episode, we will probably also talk a little bit about Recovery Month, because it is a passion of ours. And like I said, September is two different awareness months. And so we just want to kind of highlight that and just connect people to resources. That's really what it's about. And again, if you have any questions, comments, any things that you want us to include, please do reach out to us. We don't bite. And we are, you know, definitely open to having some dialogue. So until next time, hopefully you guys will soar. And if not, you're glide when you need to.
Absolutely. You all have a good one. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in and allowing us to be vulnerable together as we soar. If you enjoyed this episode and are interested in hearing more from us, make sure you hit that follow button so you are alerted when a new episode drops, and leave a rating and a review below. Our podcast can be found on all major podcast platforms, as well as YouTube. We'd love to hear your comments and how you're choosing to soar these next couple of weeks. Interact with us on Instagram at @whatifisoar, as well as on our business pages at Free to Be Counseling Services and at Social MacGyver. Let's continue ascending or gliding, even amongst the turbulence.